EFT Champagne 90.1 FM. Thanks for tuning in to your community radio station, where you could hear jazz every Monday through Friday morning from 9 until 11:30.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by Elliott Counseling. Elliott Counseling Group has a diverse group of 30 licensed therapists providing individual, group, family, and marital therapy. Elliott Counseling is currently offering teletherapy sessions and an online support group to help navigate the emotional aspects of these difficult times. Kevin Elliott Counseling has locations near downtown Champaign, close to Campus Town, in Lincoln Square Mall, and in Tuscola. More information is available online at Kevin Elliott, that's Kevin, ELLIOTT.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Good evening. You are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM radio. This is the program Where We Are At. This is a pre-recorded show. The date is February 15th. Monday, 2021. It is a cold night and getting some pretty intense snowy weather. I hope you are staying safe. I hope you are in a safe environment. I hope you are staying warm. We have quite the show today, so I hope you are able to listen to the whole hour. I have two candidates for the Urbana City Council. Just a reminder that there is in Urbana a election coming up. Yes, we have another election coming up. I know we just got done with one a few months ago, but here in the city of Urbana, there are municipal elections coming up on February 23rd. For more information about that, if you are a Urbana resident and are interested, you can go to the Champaign County Clerk website. If you would like, just type in champaigncountyclerk.com. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And now you are about to hear my first interview with the Urbana City Council candidate, Deborah Liu. I'm talking with Deborah Liu, who I believe is running for Urbana City Council in Ward 3. Now, Deborah, do you want to talk a little bit about your ward and maybe what makes it stands out, if you want to kind of talk about your ward?
Yeah. So Ward 3 historically was the Black ward. And the city council has been talking a little bit about systemic racism lately. And you see the results of systemic racism in Ward 3. You see it in the way that the public infrastructure is put together. You see it in the way the roads are designed. And Ward 3, I would say in the past 5-10 years or so, has really become a ward that's full of a diverse population of individuals. So sort of your old guard or whatever of individuals in Ward 3 is the original Black homeowners. Who live in the Ellis subdivision and in that area. But in recent years, there have been a few developers who have been building large apartment complexes north of University Avenue in Ward 3. And so there's been a larger student population in Ward 3. So Ward 3 is it's a really delightful mix, people with diverse needs. And of course, you have, in theory, what should be the crown jewel of the Urbana Park District, which is Crystal Lake Park and Martin Luther King Elementary School and King Park. So yeah, a beautiful ward with diverse needs and I think a lot of opportunity.
What made you want to run for city council? I'm guessing this is the first time you've run for public office?
Yes, this is a great question. So shortly after 2016, for the 2016 presidential election, I and I think a lot of young people became extremely disillusioned with politics at the federal level, right? And I spent a lot of time, as many people did, I spent a lot of time sort of marinating in my own grief and anger about what had happened, about what was going to happen, being really, really upset about it. But I realized shortly after that election and shortly after I, you know, had enough time to sort of wallow in my feelings that no matter how much grief or anger I had towards what was happening at the federal level, there was actually very little that I could do. And really, it was just being bad for my mental health to sit here and be so incredibly pissed off about what was happening, about what was being said, right? But I mean, the flip side of that is that local politics, at the local level, the grief and anger and loud voice of one individual actually makes a huge difference. And I came to this realization that all of the decisions that actually affect your day-to-day life are made at the local level. So things like, you know, is your local school good, right? Do you feel safe sending your kids there? Do you feel that they're getting a good education. These things shake out from the decision of your local school board, right? You know, whatever the federal education secretary, right, the secretary of education says or does or spends her money on yachts, that pisses you off. But it actually, when it really shakes down, doesn't affect the quality of education that your five-year-old is getting at their local kindergarten, right? But your local school board does. And your grief and anger towards what's happening towards education in this country is better directed at your school board than federal policy. And this applies for everything. You know, your schools, your streets, you know, are there potholes in your streets? Are your streets plowed? You know, these come down from decisions that you're... But anyways, so local politics matters, right? And nowhere is this more relevant than in the recent discussions about defunding the police.
Do you kind of want to talk about the... Because this got kind of quite a bit of attention. The People's City Council, and I aired some of it, the meeting, because that got, from what I understand, online, it got more views than, I forgot, a certain person's votes in the district.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I don't know how really predictive online views are of interest in the matter. But, you know, we know there's been a ton of interest nationally in this idea, right, of defunding the police. And I think it was Rita in the People's City Council meeting who said something very succinct and I think pointed, which is that the things that the police are called to do, right, span such a wide spectrum of activities, it's really absurd and really unfair to expect an individual department to cover all of them, right? So they do everything from like shootouts to domestic violence, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, just imagining, right? Like how do you go from interviewing an 8-year-old child to determine if they need to be removed from their home to responding to, you know, an active robbery where individuals think they're armed? It just, you know, it boggles comprehension. And sort of summarize my feelings on this issue. At a very basic level, right, my feelings on this issue are that the vast majority of the interactions that the police department, nationwide, and Urbana is no exception, the vast majority of the things that they're called to do don't coincide with what their training is for. So the Urbana Police Department issues these media reports, right? Anyone can look at them and you can sort of see what the police are called to do on a day-to-day basis. And the overwhelming majority of things that the police are asked to do are respond to domestic disturbances and respond to nonviolent petty thefts, right? And like these are not things you need an armed military soldier for, right? And it's... The police, you know, have sort of become a catch-all for providing all these services that really they're not trained or equipped to provide. And I think it would be better for the community and it would be better for the police, honestly, to sort of separate those activities.
And there's also the issue of school resource officers or essentially having police officers in schools. I know last year, the Urbana School Board, I believe, voted, it was a very close vote, I think it was 5-4, that this was the school board to approve school resource officers. I think it was like $200,000, maybe $300,000. It was quite a bit of money. And then, then it went to the Urbana City Council. I believe everyone except Jared Miller was the only no vote.
Yeah,
that's been another.
Right. So,
if you want to kind of talk about, like, because that was another issue with the People's City Council meeting about should police officers or school resource officers be in schools?
Best analogy I have for this situation is that asking a school resource officer to be present in a school because the learning environment has become disruptive is like slapping a Band-Aid on gangrene. Right. So I respect the viewpoint on some level of a school board that is, you know, more in tune to the needs of the students and the educators in the Urbana School District, right? I don't deny that they feel like it's a necessary step, but the act of placing a police officer in a learning environment when you know that individuals of color and children of color are frightened and traumatized by these very institutions of police, the state, it's a desperate gasp for help from a broken system. When children don't have secure home environments, when they don't have physical safe at home and in sort of their daily activities, they are unable to learn, right? So this is a well-documented psychological effect. You know, it's I don't know how much psychology you ever took or remember, but Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? If a child does not have a warm place to sleep and sufficient food, they don't have the mental or emotional bandwidth to focus in a classroom, right? And I don't know how anyone can look at the state of the environment in the Urbana School District and say that we don't need to address these issues on a deeper level, right? It's, well, I'm just going to kind of repeat myself, but you need to address these deeper issues. And it's not easy and it's not quick, right? And these are not sorts, this is not something you can resolve in one or two city council meetings. But if the city is going to spend these resources, right, the city should be spending the resources trying to fix the source of the problem, not trying to scramble and suppress the symptoms after the fact. And really, I think that's what school resource officers are doing. They're responding to a symptom rather than addressing the root cause.
And to kind of keep on, because I think this is what, you know, we're asking police officers, a lot of people would agree, we're asking them to do more than what they are required to do outside of their field of expertise in terms of handling, whether it's a person who is going through maybe dealing with traumatic or mental health kind of situation, where it'd be maybe best for, instead of a police officer, say a social worker and maybe, or some kind of counsel person. It seems like we're, and this is, I believe, forgetting his name, but I did bring this up too. Give someone a hammer and everything looks like a
everything
nail.
Starts to look like a nail. I agree with the sentiment of that idea, that right, that police are punitive when what we really need is someone who provides, you know, actual resources for individuals who are struggling. I agree with this idea that rather than police officers, you need social workers, right? But I'm also wary of this idea that, you know, if we just replaced all police officers with social workers, it would fix everything, right? So again, we're sort of, you're still dealing with the problem when it's already way down the line. It's better to have a social worker than a police officer, but it's still not getting to the root cause of the problem.
Obviously, and do hear about this, and this is, I think, a national problem for a lot of kids. A lot of places where they get their meals, get their things like, you know, meals is school.
Mm-hmm. Meals and undivided adult attention.
Yeah.
And school is their safe place.
That's their safe place. And obviously, yeah. given the current conditions with the situation of COVID, how has that affected? Has that affected, or maybe did that play a part in you wanting to run with how? Because I think that's affected a lot of people's lives. Is with the pandemic, they maybe lost work. They're looking at maybe they're behind on rent or bills or utilities. Did that is that something you've also seen in your district as well?
So I decided to run for council well before COVID was sort of on our radar. But I will say that one of the reasons I decided to run specifically for council is I was extremely frustrated with the way that the city council was handling a lot of issues. And COVID just sort of became one more item on a large plate of issues that I was extremely frustrated about. I will say that I think the city was doing its best with the resources that they have and with sort of the institutional structure that they had to respond. But in general, I'm extremely frustrated with what I perceive to be just a profound lack of imagination in the way the city responds. If there ever was a time to do things that were out on a limb and risky, it was going to be during a pandemic when your people were dying. Yeah, COVID is just one other thing that the city tried its best and I found it very lacking.
Let's say if you are elected onto your Urbana City Council, how do you plan? And because I've talked this with Clarissa, you want to get things done on the Urbana City Council. You have to get people on your side. You have to get the votes. You have to get, was it 3, 4? And, you know, just a reminder, people, the primary in Urbana, it's just Urbana, is Tuesday, February 23rd. I believe you can go on the Champaign County Clerk's website, champaignecountyclerk.com.
Yeah, request your vote by mail ballot. So Urbana, in Urbana, most people run as Democrats. So this is the primary is actually the one that really matters in this case.
What would be one of your first things if you win and you're on the city council? What would be one of your first things to do on your agenda?
The world is my oyster. So I should first point out that in Urbana city government, 5 city council members qualifies as a supermajority. They overwrite the mayor, and it's basically a veto-proof majority. So it's not, you know, it's not some sort of grand pie in the it's not like getting a supermajority in Congress, right? It's very much an achievable thing, right? Yeah. If a small group of individuals that really has bold progressive ideas shows up, they can do a lot of things. Well, I'm running on a thousand issues, but sort of 3 issues for the sake of the soundbite. The first issue is that Urbana needs to do more to attract and retain small businesses. Not businesses all, right? Because, you know, you wouldn't want a Walmart down the street, but you want a small family-owned restaurant, right? So small businesses, they're good for the life of a neighborhood. And this idea that things that you need for your daily life should sort of be within walking distance. And that only happens when you get stuff like corner neighborhood grocery stores, right? And small businesses that are scattered throughout the city. Well, they're good for neighborhoods. neighborhoods, right? They'd raise property values, and they also serve as a sales tax base for the city. So really, the way the city currently, I don't think the city does enough to encourage small businesses. And actually, very recently, the city actually decided to cut off the Urbana Business Association at the knees, took away their funding, hired away, I think their director was his title, but Darius White. Yeah. So it's short-sighted, in my opinion, and really it's bad for the budget in the long term, and it's bad for the life of the city. You know, Urbana, like the sort of business you need in Urbana, you're not talking about like the chain shops at Marketplace. When people think, oh, I'm going to go shopping at my local downtown, they're thinking like these small quirky stores. They weren't planning on making purchases, right? But you know, you go and you browse and you buy stuff. And these are the sorts of things that sustain a downtown, that bring life to a downtown. There's a lot of things the city could do about the way that the Urbana small business grants are dispersed, about the way that the city zones, a lot of little things that could be done to encourage small businesses. The second issue is traffic safety. In the past 18 months, Champaign County has had 6 deaths of pedestrians and cyclists dying, you know, on their way to work, on their way to the store. And it's really unacceptable. It puts us on a per capita vulnerable. So I'm going to use this phrase, vulnerable road user. Basically, it means anyone not in a car. It really puts us on a per capita equal to or exceeding large cities like Chicago and Boston, which it's just really unacceptable for a town of our size to have this amount of traffic deaths. Just a couple of weeks ago in January, there was an individual killed on Main Street. They were just crossing the street to get home and they were struck by another individual, and there are no citations issued. Neither the driver nor the individual who was killed, to my knowledge, were impaired. And when something like that happens, it's, you know, when someone cannot be very clearly pointed to as at fault, it's very clear that the design of the road is bad, right? The way that North America in general, United States specifically, the way we design roads is really about 30 years out of date. You know, when you compare it to Europeans design roads, when we make infrastructure that's car centric, right? When really, in order to feel safe getting from point A to point B, you need to get in your 2-ton internal combustion engine vehicle. It's bad for your household finances because you have to maintain a car. It's bad for the environment because you're shedding bits of tire and it's getting into the roadways, and it's bad for the air quality. It's bad for your daily quality of life, right? Like, people don't realize how much frustration and anger is spent sitting in traffic until you set yourself free from that. To do that, what the really city needs to do is invest in non-vehicle infrastructure that's designed for single occupancy vehicles. So we're talking buses.
Yeah, right? Buses.
We're talking better sidewalks.
Public transportation.
Public transit. We're talking about protected bike lanes. Urbana does not have a single protected bike lane, which I just find I just find profoundly unacceptable. The only thing that even comes close is the slightly grade separated lanes that were put in on Green Street with the MCOR project. And it's very simple. When you build safe, protected bike infrastructure, people bike, right? You build it and they will come. And if you build it and people switch their transportation modes to biking, not only are the roads safer and you don't have to feel unsafe walking with your child because you think you're going to get hit by a driver distracted by their phone, it reduces the wear and tear on the roads. It reduces the cost of public works because bikes wear down a road less than cars do. Sorry, I'm sort of rambling, but road safety.
Sure.
Road safety. Yeah. Individuals should feel safe walking, right? And they don't because, or I'll just say this, Urbana builds terrible roads. Yeah. Urbana builds terrible, outdated, stupid roads that prioritize vehicle safety, vehicle speeds, over people safety. Yeah, anyways. And then there's precedent. You know, there's other small college towns that have managed to get their vehicle mode share up to, you know, 50% of trips, you know, are taken by bicycle or by foot in other cities. In Urbana, it's like 20 or something. So road safety, right? Road safety. Urbana can do better, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Urbana just needs to think a little bit more creatively in the way we put in roads. The third issue is policing. No matter how you slice it, the city of Urbana spends around $11 million a year on funding the police. And well, think of all the good things you could do for $11 million. Think of all the kids you could feed for $11 million, right? Like, what services do the police provide that require $11 million? And the thing is, I think Chris Hansen was the one who pointed this out. Was it Chris? I don't know.
I think it was, yeah.
I think it was, who said that objectively, the police budget as a fraction of city budget and in sort of gross dollar amount, it's risen much faster than inflation. And in return, the city has not gotten safer, right? Homicides have not gone down. Violent crime has not gone down. So objectively, spending more money on policing does not work, right? Regardless of whether or not you think the police are necessary for the safety of a city, if you want public safety, policing is not the way, is not where you want to put your money. Move that budget money.
Back to the People's City Council. Did they have another event on the domestic title, violence?
Yes. It's coming up.
Is there anything, what's that going to be entail? Or?
So the primary discussion, as far as I'm aware, around the domestic violence issue is that when individuals stay in abusive or bad relationships, most of the time it's because of a resource issue, right? Mm-hmm. Their abuser has the lease and they don't feel like they could find a place to stay if they left, or it's economic, right? They don't know if they could afford it to leave, right? So they stay. So if you're going to address domestic violence, what you really need to do is address a resource issue. You need to give abused individuals a place to go. You need to provide resources for them to be able to escape these bad situations. That's the discussion as far as I'm aware.
I mean, there's shelters. Like, I know Austin's place is the women's shelter. I believe that's the women's mm-hmm. shelter. I'm blanking on the men. There's also one for men. The Phoenix. It's at the Phoenix Center or the mm-hmm. where the Times location used to be. But yeah, essentially what, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times to handle with domestic violence is essentially you need to give the person that's being abused, you need to mm-hmm. essentially give them an alternate place to stay, or not, because mm-hmm. that's essentially, they have nowhere else, they don't have a place to go and they're unfortunately forced to.
Correct. Yeah. And shelters are the beginning of the conversation. It's sort of been rightfully pointed out that Urbana does not have any homeless shelter or places for individuals to go. They're all in Champaign. But that's really the beginning of the conversation. You know, no one in their right mind wants to go to a homeless shelter. And by and large, homeless shelters are not safe places. They're not really pleasant places.
Well, and
especially
right now,
for an individual who has small children or fears for the physical safety, right? Yeah. Things have to get bad before you put going to a homeless shelter into the equation.
Yeah, and of course, right now, once again, to bring up COVID-19, it's really just made, it's really kind of made.
Yeah, especially now.
I'll keep it short, but I feel like a lot of problems with things like wealth inequality, homelessness, mm-hmm. or housing, I feel like this is just me speaking, but I feel like, you know, this country has been kind of sweeping those problems under the rug. And oof. now with COVID-19, it's just kind of like really brought those problems.
COVID-19 is emphasizing, it's really bringing to light where the pitfalls are in our country, where has our system really, really failed us? And housing is one of them. So I'm going to segue a little bit here.
Sure.
To all your listeners. I'd be interested to hear your views on this topic, but you know, like sort of the rallying cry of the democratic socialists is like tax the rich, right? Soak the rich, et cetera, right? Pay for healthcare. So one thing I've been thinking about a lot is how do you tax the rich in a municipal environment when state law does not allow local governments to levy an income tax? So I read that one of the consequences of the Fair Tax Amendment that was shot down, unfortunately, in the past election was that municipalities would have had a legal power to levy an income tax, which would have been great, but it didn't pass. So it's kind of a moot point. But anyways, how do you tax the rich when you're not allowed to impose income taxes? The best thing I've been able to come up with is that in Urbana-Champaign, or in Champaign County as a whole, really, who are the rich? And the rich are the landlords. They are, it's great. It's like something straight out of a textbook about Marx. But the rich are the landlords, right? So those are the owners who have the enormous apartment complexes, you know, built by developers from out of state. Everyone from those developers all the way down to the landlords who own, you know, 4, 5, 6 rental homes in Champaign County, because it's profitable to be a landlord in Champaign County, because the rent to housing cost ratio is profitable for an individual to buy and rent homes. So how do we tax the rich, right? When we know that the rich are the landlords, the rich are the property owners in Champaign County. The only thing that I've been sort of been able to come up with is this idea of imposing a progressive property tax. For example, on homes from like worth $10,000 to $50,000, you impose such and such a percentage property tax. On homes worth $200,000, you impose such and such a property tax. I'm not 100% sure it's legal. I know it's been done in other states, but I don't know if it applies in Illinois. That's one thing I came up with. And the other thing I came up with is Urbana already imposes a rental fee program, right? So if you own a rental property, you know, based on the number of doors, you pay X amount on an annual basis. And the nominal purpose of that fee is to support the City of Urbana housing inspectors who come out and make sure that the property, you know, is livable and doesn't have blatant code violations and such. I don't see a reason why the city can't arbitrarily increase that amount. And I think especially the city needs to increase the amount on a per door basis for larger units. It's something like $60 for a single family home and like $12 per unit or something for units above 12 or something. I forget the exact details, But the point is, it becomes cheaper to on a per unit basis the more units you have. And I think it should be flipped. I think that property owners who own many rental units should be paying a disproportionate amount to fund city services. And it would be poetic if we, you know, were able to channel some of that money into alleviating homelessness in our town. Because really, there's no good reason that we should have simultaneous vacant rental units and homeless individuals. It just, you know, it's not efficient. So anyways, I'd welcome the opinion of your listeners.
Sure.
You know, you guys, if you search my name, you'll find my Facebook page, or you can email me at Deborah Lou for UrbanaWord3@gmail.com.
Please be respectful.
Yeah.
Even at the local level, I'm kind of surprised how hostile and vitriol people can get.
Oh yeah? You get hate mail? Yeah, that's how you know you've made it, when you start getting hate mail.
Hey, I guess any kind of publicity is good. Anyways, I think, and this is, you know, if you have time, I guess what I've kind of noticed, obviously, we kind of go back on the policing, because again, that seems to be obviously the hot topic and issue with this Urbana City Council election. With what happened with Aaliyah Lewis, I think that's played a big part in the marches and rallies that we had last summer. We had one of the biggest, I think Champaign-Urbana had one of the biggest marches in its city history. I think with what happened with, and that was obviously part of the whole national movement with the policing against police reform, or if you want to call it defund the police. I know that was, you know, this is whole, you know, a whole conversation around that. But essentially with what happened with Aaliyah Lewis, that's what really it caught on here in Urbana, and why that's such a hot, handled the situation with her, because she, you know, there's a lot, but it felt like they went way over the line with how they treated her. And then not only that, but they kind of made it into like a media war, kind of like they kind of, one would say, and this might be up to this discussion, but they kind of started a campaign that, or they made her look as bad as, and I think that that's what made this such a hot topic, you know, if you want to call it a hot topic issue. Obviously policing's really always been an issue, an issue. I think it's interested what you have to say about that.
Yeah, so at a very basic level, first of all, the Urbana police were using inappropriate amounts of force disproportionate to the situation. So it's a terrible but excellent example of how systemic racism works to derail the lives of Black and Brown individuals. If Aaliyah had been white, I have no doubt that the Urbana police would not have beaten her in broad daylight. They would not have chased her down. They would not have pointed a live weapon at her. And they probably wouldn't have charged her with, you know, multiple felony counts of resisting arrest and striking a police officer. And because of this event that she, as far as I can tell, had no blame in, really, except for, you know, shouting at the police officers from across the street. Her life is potentially completely derailed now. Right? She has criminal charges on her file. And, you know, regardless of what happens, this is going to follow her for the rest of her life. You know, it's unfair. It's grossly unfair when you consider that the only reason that this is happening is because of the color of her skin, because, you know, the institutions mobilized against her because she happens to be the wrong race. So, right. So that's one element of it. The city council and the police department definitely bungled the public relations portion of handling this. I recognize that they're hedging their bets against a future civil lawsuit against the city, but what they've said, what they've done has been incredibly tone deaf. They've entirely missed the point, I feel like, when the way they responded to this issue.
I would say, from my experience as a reporter covering local government, people's attention to their local city council and school boards, they're not always paying attention, which is why voter turnout is not always so high, and why our institutions aren't always held to accountable, because people aren't paying attention.
Local government, for better or for worse, just doesn't attract the same attention that federal and state politics does, which, you know, it's really backwards. As I said earlier, decisions that really affect you are made at the local level. And while it's true that, you know, if you pick a random city council meeting from the past 5 years, you know, from last April, there are nuances, you know, get all worked up, I should say. But these decisions really, really have consequences for the way a city is put together, right? I mean, redlining, right? Historic redlining is just one example. Regions are zoned in a specific way. The city is explicitly saying this is the kind of neighborhood that we're trying to put together, right? And the details of those ordinances really have implications for the character for the character of a neighborhood.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. Guests are actively participating in case management services and working toward finding more stable housing options. Crisis Nursery is another option. Crisis Nursery is the only emergency-based child care facility open 24 hours, 365 days a year, serving ages birth through 6 years. It is open for the entire community to access with no fees or income eligibility. Besides safe shelter for children, family support and parenting education are provided. Families who may be experiencing a crisis are welcome to call the phone number 217-337-2730. Again, that phone number is 217-337-2730 to begin the process of scheduling care for their child or children. There is also Austin's Place, which is a women's only shelter. Austin's Place provides overnight emergency shelter for women year-round. Intakes are from 8 p.m. to 7 p.m. and are available throughout the night. New facilities, including showers and laundry, are now available. If you need the address is 504 North Market Street. Again, the address is 504 North Market Street in Champaign. For more information, contact Ruth Moore. The phone number is 217-356-9078. Again, that phone number is 217-356-9078. There is also the Men's Emergency Shelter, which provides, again, year-round, 365 days a year, and same hours, 8 p.m. to 7 a.m. Service provides at CU at Home, the address is 70 East Washington Street in Champaign, the former Time Center location. Showers and laundry are available, and the phone number to contact is 217-819-4569. It's the Men's Emergency Shelter, 217-819-4569. Also, another phone number is 217-649-2200. Again, that phone number is 217-649-2200. The Men's Emergency Shelter, located at 70 East Washington Street, the former Times Center location. Talking with, is it Jake?
Yeah, you are right, Bob.
Now, you are running for city council in Urbana, Ward 1. What can you kind of tell me about Ward 1? I mean, specify which part, what it covers, but what's about it that's distinct?
Yeah, for sure. So, first off, Ward 1 is the second youngest average age of the wards in Urbana. The first youngest being Ward 2. And part of the reason for that is, if you look at the map, Ward 1 captures a good chunk of the east side of the University of Illinois campus. So even the main quad is in Ward 1. So Ward 1 is the closest to being the university ward. So there's the student housing on the south side of campus, and then a whole bunch of the area that Ward 1 encompasses. It is a range. Because it's not just student housing, it's not just people who are younger. There's a diverse set of constituents, but that's some of the biggest things. It's a campus ward. It's got some of the youngest population in Urbana.
Jake, what made you want to run for Urbana City Council? It's not something young people. Well, I guess you're seeing more young people, I think, involved in politics, and I have a suspicion why. It has something to do with something that happened in 2016.
Thank you very much.
But why did you run for city council?
Yeah, I guess, Ben, the biggest things were coming to terms with and starting to understand how my experience in the world and in this country is different and has been shaped by the person, my identity, the person that I am. So basically, the ways that being a white, heterosexual, cis dude from a middle-class background has shielded me from a lot of the injustices that so many other Americans experience. So it's a process of just in particular the past few years, partially in response to a lot of things going on, like you mentioned, but learning more about the history of oppression in the United States, and hearing about how things still aren't equal today. Like, for example, the justice system, which has clear instances of discrimination, disproportionate punishment at every level, you know? So like things like that. And the more that I learn, the more that it fires me up, and the more I realize, like, I have a real opportunity here to use my privilege and my voice to amplify the voices of more marginalized folks and fight for their rights.
What would you say are some of the big issues or parts of your campaign that you're really speaking out about, or that you're really passionate about?
Yeah, so my big three are housing insecurity. So that's everything from being rent burdened. Actually, like over 2/3 of people in Champaign County are rent burdened, which means they spend more than 1/3 of their income on rent. And all the way up to actual homelessness. There's potentially several hundred people that are homeless in Champaign County, which is absurd considering we have like 10 times as many vacant properties that could be, you know, could be housing people. So housing insecurity is a huge one. I mentioned the justice system. Police reform is a huge place. We need to figure out exactly what we want our police to be doing, to be responding to, what sort of responsibilities we want police to have, and where there's some responsibilities or types of calls that could be offloaded to a different type of role or different type of professional. For example, you know, we saw there's lots of examples of this all over the country, but the one that was in the news a lot recently is Denver, which is replacing a lot of their police calls to domestic type calls with social workers. And they've had huge success with it. People are a lot safer. The social workers can handle the situations a lot better. You know, a lot of times police just aren't trained to deal with a person in a mental health crisis. That's not something that's within the training they receive. So police reform is another huge area where I think there's a lot of work to be done.
And since we're on that subject, you took part in the People's City Council on defunding the police, and you brought up how 21% of Urbana's budget goes to police. So in terms of, and that, of course, that was a big subject last year during the summer after those national protests that happened. And that was one of the biggest key phrases was defunding the police. Now, so could you kind of go more into that? You know, what does defunding the police mean or entail?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked, because definitely that's a phrase has a lot of weight attached to it. And depending on who you are, you hear that phrase, you might have a gut reaction one way or another. And that's valid, you know, because I'm saying, I said this in the People's Council, a few years ago, I would have had that same gut reaction of negativity to a phrase like that, like defund the police, you know, like I don't want to do that. You know, police keep our community safe, you know, and I would jump to all those things that people tend to say. But I would say now in present year, where I'm much more informed and aware of the way that the police operates, I have a sort of a different opinion. And that would be, so I would say, first of all, defunding the police looks different for every single community, for sure. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution. I would say you can point to some examples where complete abolishment of the police department has worked in some communities. There's several in the United States that have done it. One city, I can't remember the name now, so I won't try to
Newark, New Jersey. Somewhere, it was like New Jersey, I think.
I think that's the one, yeah. Newark, where they actually abolished their police department 7 years ago. And since then, they've had an over 50% reduction in crime, which is way better than the national average. So there are examples where that complete abolishment has worked in replacement with alternative models. But there's also a lot of other changes that we can, a lot of smaller changes we can start making. And so the biggest thing that I'm interested in pushing for is kind of what the Denver model is looking at right now. And what we were just talking about a second ago is looking at what we actually want our police to do, because the police are trained to do a specific kind of job. And maybe there's a case to be made that that training and their preparation is appropriate for some types of situations. But there's other types of situations where not only are police not very well equipped to deal with them, like domestic calls, like we were just talking about, or mental health crises, but also sometimes bringing in police can make the situation worse. And we've seen countless examples of that. Probably the most recent was, what was that case where it was like a young girl gets got pepper sprayed. It was like a 7-year-old girl having a mental health crisis. Yeah, not in our community.
No, it was an eight-year-old, and she said, and the police said, "You're acting like a child." And she said, "That's because I am a child."
Yeah. And I think that to speak as to, because people will say like, "Oh, that's just some cops." It really goes to the way that cops are prepared and the training that they receive that causes them to react in some of those ways. The most clear example of that is, if you've ever heard of Dave Grossman, there it is, Dave Grossman. Let me just tell you a couple of things about him. He's a self-proclaimed killologist. That's like what he calls himself, just exactly what it sounds like. He's devoted himself to the study of how people take the lives of other people. And his training, he's like a rock star in the police community. Basically, the main points that he brings up is his worldview is kind of splitting people up into these three categories. There's like the sheep, which in this analogy are the citizens. They're the people who can't defend themselves, and they're preyed upon by wolves. And wolves are anybody who's a criminal, you know, who falls under that category of criminal. And these wolves, all they want to do is prey on sheep. And so police come into the picture as the sheepdogs. And so it's almost like a divine purpose of like, you're here to defend the sheep from the wolves. And if somebody, basically what it causes people to think of is, if somebody's not a sheep, they're automatically a wolf. Mm. And this kind of binary around crime, that if you're either a criminal and you do bad things or you're not. And the truth is, the causes of crime are way more complex than that. And there's lots of people that are criminals or commit crimes one point in their life, then never do it again, you know, situations like that. So it's kind of like viewing the world in that binary, and this, the attitude that, you know, anything, this is another thing he always says, anyone is a threat and anything can be a weapon. You know, he'll tell stories of like, you know, if somebody, you'd give somebody a chance, if they even just have a pen, they could kill you with it, you know? Mm. And it causes police to, you know, rightfully fear for their lives and kind of go into every single situation with this heightened awareness and this like paranoia that anything and anybody could be out to kill them. And when you go into every situation like that, you're going to end up with some cases where you pepper spray. There's police that pepper spray 8-year-olds, you know?
And I know last year, I believe it was the Urbana School Board voted, it was a close vote to have school resource officers. I think it was a few hundred thousand dollars, maybe even $300,000. And then it went to the Urbana School Board votes on something. It usually goes to the city council, and I think the city council approved it. The only no vote. So since you would have, I'm guessing, would have voted no against having school resource officers, and as you stated before, put that towards having like a social worker or some kind of counselor, that would be your view or take on, but you would say we don't need more police officers in schools, correct?
Yeah, it's great. Actually, great that you bring that one up, because I think that, or at least one of the like Urbana School District board meetings was like the first ever public comment section that I ever attended. I didn't say anything. I just came to watch. But I think that was like the very first time I ever like went somewhere and saw, you know, public giving input on stuff. It was really interesting. And with that case in particular, with the SROs, I think like, because, and you brought up the point about like the massive investment it costs to hire an SRO, or in the case, I think this was hiring two separate SROs for the two schools as opposed to sharing them over one. But that's a massive expenditure. And compared to the cost of hiring an additional social worker or a counselor for the school, it's like, it's so much smaller. It's almost half as much. And so like when you see a choice like that, I think that's like a clear choice between investing money into things that address the effects of crime and criminal type behavior. So that's the police, who can only respond to crime, right? Police don't ever prevent crimes from happening. That's not something that police are here to do. Whereas, and the other option, investing into social work and investing into counselors, those are things that are proven, like research proven, like there's tons of data about this, to reduce crime and criminal behavior. So like you have a clear choice there. Do we invest in addressing the effects or addressing the causes? And to me, it's obviously every time, let's pick the causes. Let's think about the people here.
If elected, what's going to be one of your firsts? What do you think will be one of your first issues or things to act on? I mean, obviously now with COVID, I think that's kind of changed everything, you know, in terms of what to look at first. And if you're elected, what's going to be one of your first issues or actions that you think should be acted on?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And I think for me, probably the two biggest things to jump on were, you know, what I talked about earlier regarding housing insecurity and police reform. As far as specific actions, when it comes to housing insecurity, there's been a few examples, and this is actually what that first People's Council event was about. It was about homelessness and housing insecurity. There's been cities all across the country, and the example that they keep pointing to is Rockford, Illinois, that have ended chronic homelessness in their communities. Because the truth is, a lot of communities are just like ours. As I mentioned before, the amount of vacant rental units that we have in our county dwarfs the number of people who are chronically homeless by over 10 times. We have 10 times as many properties that aren't being used right now that could need to house those people. So like when you talk about homelessness, it's a political problem. The resources exist to solve it, but the will to funnel those resources into helping those people and put together a coordinated effort into actually addressing those issues isn't there right now. So that would be a huge first place. I would love to take after some of those other communities like Rockford. Basically the first steps they take is consolidation of efforts, because like a lot of other places, we have lots of folks doing great work around homelessness in this community. The Cunningham Township folks come to mind. CU at Home is doing work with that. Even like the Women's Resource Center at the University of Illinois. There's all these different places that are trying to help these folks, but right now they're kind of operating in their own like silos. So they're kind of operating separately from one another. They don't have a lot of communication between them and coordination across their silos. That's part of why this problem is so difficult to solve. Everybody is working their butts off, you know, but they're doing it in their different silos, and they don't have the time, they don't have the resources to be able to connect with these other folks. That's where the city council comes in. And making an initiative and, you know, drawing a resolution to put together a coordinated effort to bring all of the stakeholders into the room or the virtual room and have that conversation and start to figure out where can we draw lines between each other and work together to actually solve this issue. That's where a city council and, like I said, getting the political will to solve that problem can be super important. So that would be, I think, the first step or one first thing is putting together that coordinated effort, getting everybody in the room and having that conversation. That would be a huge thing.
And she's running for Champaign. Talked about how she was like, look, you know, I'm not, you know, for, you know, and she feels differently, but I think she brought up her take and her issue. And there's 9 people on the city council, right? I don't know if that includes the mayor. I mean, how would you go about, you know, you always hear, this is another thing you always hear about politics, usually here in Congress, but it's thing in the city council about bipartisanship working. And Urbana is mostly Democrat, unlike Champaign, which is more conservative. But obviously, even not all Democrats are alike. I mean, just look at this past election. But what's your way of getting that in terms of getting people on to look at an issue? So how do you think you'll be able to do that?
Yeah, and I think fundamentally this gets at the point of like, you know, even if you have the information, because a lot of these like points are literally research backed, like there's data behind this stuff. It's not like this is a secret. People's minds don't change because of information, right? That's the thing we know now more than ever because of social media, right? Like people don't change their minds just because they're told that information is wrong. It has more to do with their deeply ingrained core beliefs about themselves, about the world, about society and how it should operate. And in order to change those beliefs, it's not an instantaneous process of like introduced to this new information and then suddenly you can just flip a switch and change your mind. It's a concerted effort. It takes time. It's an uncomfortable process. I was raised in a pretty, I would say, conservative home. My parents are like pretty moderate. They definitely go back and forth like voting wise. But in terms of their attitudes, definitely more on the conservative side than the progressive side. And I too internalized a lot of those beliefs growing up. And it's like I mentioned earlier, it's only been these past few years when I've started to change those beliefs. And it's a continual process too. It's not, I'm definitely not completed that process. I'm not like suddenly woke, you know, like I'm still learning lots of new things. I'm still realizing where my core beliefs have led me wrong in the past, things like that. But I think when it comes to convincing folks in the council, for example, I think it's a matter of hearing them. Let's hear what your concerns are. Let's have a conversation about this because I'm genuinely curious. I wanna know what's bothering you about these ideas, what's bothering you about this, you know, resolution, whatever that is. And let's talk it out. Let's get a sense of what thoughts that you're having about this, what your reactions are. And then let's look a little bit deeper and figure out why you might be having those reactions. And what are the root causes? What experiences have you had or information have you been exposed to that have shaped your beliefs to be in that way? Because I think that's where there's the clearest opportunity, or once we get down to that point, when we get down to that root cause, then we can start to figure out, okay, where are some of these beliefs a little bit flawed? Or where were some of these beliefs, I mean, in many examples, manipulated by things like very clever marketing and propaganda and all the media that you've been exposed to throughout your life? How are those things shaping your core beliefs to be a certain way? And once you have that awareness and we start to have that conversation, then we can start to talk about, okay, how can we start to adjust and how can we change things?
In terms of, I know the controversy you got a lot of, was it taken too well from a lot of people, was about what happened with the public comments, wanted to limit public comments, the change that was made to that by the council, because they thought that. Do you have any information on what happened with?
Yeah, well, I'd say I back up first to say I don't like the current, you know, system of public comments in general, you know, like the time boxed 3 to 5 minute opportunity to speak your mind. It's never an effective way of like actually collecting meaningful feedback from people, because one, I mean, it's such a short time, and two, it's like you're under the pressure to both like give your information and like give your feelings. It's such a like stressful thing, having the timer, the giant timer on the screen, you know, all this stuff. So first of all, I'd be much more interested in exploring ways to collect public input that aren't this like very rudimentary way of inviting people up to say your piece for a tiny bit of time and then leave. In a lot of the work that I do for the university, we do a lot of, it's called a human-centered design. Basically, it's like an approach to problem solving that puts people at the center. And what that looks like in the projects that we do is we have long one-on-one conversations with the people that we're designing for or for the other stakeholders that are in a project. These are like sometimes upwards of an hour and usually at least like 40 to 50 minutes. And it's all about what we were talking about before. It's all about the why. It's not only what are you feeling and how are you feeling, and let me validate that, like that's absolutely, you know, you're feeling that, that's real. But now let's get a little bit to the why and let's figure out what matters to you, really, and what experiences and beliefs do you have that are shaping these thoughts and attitudes? So that's definitely something I would be really interested in exploring. Like if it was something like, I don't know, city council members have to like interview or like have these one-on-one conversations with like a certain number of constituents every week or every month or something like that. I think that would be an awesome way to look into ways to get public input that are actually helpful. With this particular situation you're talking about, I think it was something to do with, I think Mayor Marlin can mute people on Zoom, which is enormous power in a virtual city council meeting, right?
Yeah.
And I think they were cutting off people who were talking trash about officials, like that was kind of their criteria.
Oh yeah, there was I guess they thought somebody or people were being a little bit too vocal and very critical. I guess they thought it went over the line, and that's why they changed format of the public comments. I think that was one of the reasons.
No, that sounds right. That's sort of my understanding as well. And I mean, I think if you are going to be resistant to receiving that criticism, you shouldn't be in public office. I think, you know, like that's probably going to happen to every single person who runs for any office. I think, welcome that stuff. I think embrace it with open arms. But I think, like, I guess their qualms with it, or their qualms with the situation, is that if people are just, like, trash-talking officials and just, like, sometimes it's not, they're not giving as much of the productive, you know, or quote-unquote productive, like, information that they're trying to get out of public input. And honestly, I think that, again, speaks to this format. It's a flaw of the format. If you only have 3 minutes or you only have 4 minutes, are you going to waste your time starting with a whole exposition, bringing in your points one by one? No, you're not going to talk about any of that stuff. You're just going to focus on what's most important, which is what you're feeling right now and what you want the city council to know that you're feeling. I definitely disagree with muting anybody for public comment, but I think the fact that public comment tends to turn into just a rant fest speaks to the fact that the system is flawed, that the way that they do it is flawed.
There was also talks of, you know, with back to defunding the, you know, about the whole police situation. In terms of what can be done, there was talks of the People's City Council about a citizen review board, whether that would be to kind of look into any kind of policing issues. That was a possible solution. Was there anything more or anything about that specifically that you wanted to, would that be a possible solution, or would that just be seen as not efficient?
Oh, that's a great question. And yeah, so to that point, there is a civilian police review board in the city of Urbana. And it's exactly what you're describing. And I think it's great that those things exist. It's super important to have a third party be evaluating these types of cases. The problem, and I think somebody brought it up in that meeting, these boards don't have any power. Legally, the police institution can defend police from almost any sort of situation. This is that qualified immunity. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. But basically, it's protections for police in legal cases and in trials. And basically, it's like if there's a precedent, or if, let me see, I want to make sure I represent it correctly.
While you do that, and doesn't the mayor appoint the people on this? Wouldn't the mayor appoint the people on the citizen review board to get the mayor's approval, doesn't it?
I think you're right. Yes. Yeah. That's another place.
Well, that's another,
There's no power. It's the board exists, but they can't do anything. Okay, so it's to shield officials, government officials, which police are counted as, from being held personally liable for constitutional violations, as long as the officials did not violate a, quote, clearly established law. So basically, it's a super broad coverage that protects police from excessive use of force all over the place. Qualified immunity gets called all the time in court cases to prevent police from getting fired or from suffering from disciplinary action. So it's things like that. It's things like the mayor being filter. It's things like qualified immunity. It's things like the power that police unions have. That's a huge part of this whole system, is police unions, well, not only in enforcing or continuing the cycle of violence that dudes like Dave Grossman, we were talking about earlier, are proponents of, but they also protect police from accountability. That's their primary function. And it's funny because, like, union, you hear, like, union, and a lot of people like me are like, yeah, like, unions are great. Like, we want people to be able to stick up for their rights. Police union, completely different than any other union that's out there. Yeah. And a lot of what they do is exactly this. It's protecting police from ever being accountable for their actions. So, yeah, I think those are, like, there's a lot of other places where there needs to be more checks and balances for something like a civilian police review board to actually be effective. And that's, like, the main problem that they're facing right now.
But, like, tell any people about voting, because I know there's been kind of concern with how many people, you know, what's the voter turnout going to be with it seems like you have a lot, you're dealing with all these obstacles, you know, one, the weather, you got, you know, all this snowy weather, and then, you know, you got the pandemic, and I also think people are kind of tired.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you're totally right about voter turnout is going to be a big, you know, thing. We're all just trying to get more folks out to vote, and I'll do that plug real quick. If you don't know how to vote, you can visit the Champaign County Clerk's website. That will have information on who's on your ballot, where you can vote. You can vote early now. at the Brookings Administration Center. And you can also right now request a vote by mail ballot. If we're doing vote by mail again, of course, that's a great way to get your vote in. Otherwise, you can do any of that up until February 23rd, which is the last day of this primary. And then there's going to be another one in April. That's going to be the general election.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates.
And that's going to wrap up this programming of Where We Are At here on 90.1 FM radio. Please stay tuned for more programming, but also have a good night and stay warm, stay safe. Take care.
Hi, Champaign County's own native child, Tom Baudette here, for the American value of wearing pants in public. Well, not just pants, but face coverings, too. You might have heard there's a pandemic going around. It's on a hard upswing in Champaign County again, and even healthy-looking people can spread it. Pretty people, ugly people, anyone. So for your friends and neighbors, remember to keep your distance from others.